Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a very cool show for you this week. Up first is actor Eric Braeden, who plays ruthless businessman Victor Newman on the number one daytime drama, The Young and the Restless. Eric talks about his amazing career, including his award-winning work on Y&R, as well as playing John Jacob Astor in James Cameron's Titanic. We then speak with technology columnist Mark Saltzman about the latest on the new iPad. He has all the deets to help you decide if this is a gadget for you. We then wrap things up with a remix from Jason Derulo.
Capture your need for sound.
I am thrilled to introduce you to my next guest. He's one of the most recognized film and television actors in the world, and he's won numerous awards, including an Emmy and People's Choice Award, not to mention he even has his own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He played John Jacob Astor in the Titanic, and you've seen him for years as savvy and ruthless businessman Victor Newman on the number one daytime drama, The Young and the Restless. Eric Braeden, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Merci beaucoup et bonjour, Kelly.
Merci beaucoup, Eric. Now, I have to start off by asking...
Tu parles français aussi?
Oui, je parle français à cause que ici, c'est français à Québec.
Je ne peux parler beaucoup, mais un peu, un petit peu.
Un petit peu, c'est bien ça, c'est très bien. I wanted to ask you, Eric, you just were speaking in French, and I know that you actually weren't born in the U.S., you were born in Germany. Why did you actually decide to leave your home country to come over to the United States?
Oh, Kelly, that's a long story. I was 18 when I left, and after the war, you know, there was not much around, and America was always an adventure. You know, I'd seen all the films about cowboys and Indians, and America was just sort of, I think the cliche, the country of unlimited possibilities. So was Canada in the minds of a lot of Germans, for example, and a lot of Germans did come to Canada.
And how come you made the switch to go there?
Say what?
How come you made the switch to actually go to the States instead of here because of the television industry?
I had a cousin. She was a doctor. She taught at the Medical University of Texas, and she sponsored my coming to America, my immigration. So that's how I ended up in the States.
And did you always want to be an actor, Eric, or did you have ambitions to be a professional athlete? Because I know that you're very athletic. You play soccer, tennis, all that sort of good stuff.
Yeah, I had won the German Youth Championship in track and field and discus and javelin and shot put with my team. And I sort of played with the idea of acting a little bit here and there, you know. Found myself sitting at plays and wanting to play certain parts. In my mind, but never really entertained it seriously, no. And had a scholarship later on at the University of Montana in Missoula in track and field. And I studied political science and economics only for a year. Then I went to California. I took a river trip in Idaho on the River of No Return and was the first one with another guy to go up and down that river. No one had ever gone against the rapids and down again and survived it. So we were the first ones to survive it. We made a documentary film of it and came to California with that, to press conferences.
And then how did you actually get your feet wet in the acting business?
In the 60s, they needed a lot of actors who could speak German and play German parts. And that's how I started. But I must say, the first time I did it, I knew that is where I belonged. And the first time I did my first play, I really knew that acting is what I wanted to do. The play was by Jean-Paul Sartre, called Keen, in which I played the Prince of Wales. And I did another play by Tennessee Williams, and etc. And it took off rather quickly, to be honest with you. I did combats and did a series called The Rat Patrol and ran for a few years. And then I did a Broadway play with Geraldine Page and on.
And what would you consider, I guess, your first major break in acting?
A segment on Mission Impossible, where I played a Russian spy who quoted Shakespeare and was the first one to kiss Barbara Payne. And that caught the attention of someone on Broadway, namely the director, George Schaefer. and they brought me out, and I played the son of Kurt Jürgens, who then was a famous German actor, and Geraldine Page. And Clarence Williams III from Marzipan played my half-brother, and I get very good reviews for it. So the Clarence and our careers went on. Anyway.
And how did you end up getting approached to play Victor Newman on The Young and the Restless? And did you have, you know, sort of any idea at the time that your role would become such an integral part of the show?
No idea, no clue. And I was asked if I wanted to meet with them, and I asked a friend of mine, Dabney Coleman, the actor who I play tennis with a lot, what's a soap? I had no idea what a soap was. And he said, do it, you'll love it. And I went to see the producers, and the rest is history. I wanted to sign a deal for 3 months, and they wanted to extend it, and I said, okay, for a year. And then I actually wanted to leave the show because I didn't like the parameters of doing it daytime. The time is too limited. It's an enormous amount of work in a short period of time. And then they changed producers, and that changed everything for me because they were, or he was, amenable to changes in the dialogue. And there you are. The rest is history.
And Eric, is it true that being on daytime is conducive, or is one of the best avenues, I guess, as an actor who has a family life? Because I understand, or what I've heard is that it's good, you can actually have time with your family as opposed to being off on locations all the time.
And that is true. That is very true. That's a very good point. A very valid point. And I must say I'm grateful because I was able to coach my son and watch him grow up and coach him in soccer for years. I had personally won the U.S. championship in 1973, a team called the Maccabees, and so then I coached him, and since he was 5 years old or whatever. So, yes, daytime afforded me that luxury of coming home every night. You know, otherwise, as an actor, you go to different locations and or do plays in different cities, and so I'm very grateful to YNR, it afforded me to stay here and live a pretty normal life.
Now, you've been on YNR Young and the Restless for over 30 years, and you've created this character so powerful that anytime I speak to people, they either love you or hate you all at the same time. And has it been challenging for you, Eric, as an actor, to keep playing that line of being loving and kind, but kind of ruthless and controlling at the same time?
You know, I don't think about it, whether it's ruthless or not. I really don't. I've never been interested in winning popularity contests, and never. I don't give a damn. And I just do what is on the page and try to be as conscientious about it as I can. I have had a very good relationship with my fans over the years. I'm very grateful for that. And you just do the part as conscientiously as you can. And Victor Newman is indeed a complex character. I personally may disagree with a number of the decisions he has made, but nevertheless, you simply try to do every day what is in your power to do, to play a scene as realistically as possible. That's a challenge, as any actor will tell you, primarily given these rather artificial parameters where you have no time. You don't even really have a rehearsal. So you work at an enormous pace, and it's very challenging to make those scenes real, you know. But we have very good actors on the show. I'm very lucky to work with Melody Thomas-Scott and Peter Bergman and now Jeannie Francis and Joshua Morrow and Sharon Case and Michael Mooney and, you know, Michelle Stafford. I mean, we have wonderful actors on the show. So Christian Leblanc, and very blessed with very good actors. And I like what Maria Bell has been doing. The writing. So there you are.
And I wanted to ask you as well, Eric, in the fact that you know, you've been part of one of daytime's most powerful super couples, Victor and Nikki, played by Melody Thomas-Scott. Now, the two of you have this amazing on-screen chemistry. What has it been like to work with Melody for so long and, you know, keep the excitement and the passion sort of burning on screen?
I love working with her. I really love working with her. I'm blessed in that sense. So we have been getting along for over 30 years, and one or two, maybe little run-ins, but not really, disagreements. disagreements over something, but generally speaking, we really have been getting along very well. Yeah.
Do you ever
I adore working with her.
Do you ever have a laugh with her, Eric, about the fact that, you know, it's always you and Nikki being pulled together or pushed apart and then back and forth? Do you ever have a laugh with Melody about how long it's going to take before you're back together again?
We laugh at this stuff all the time. She has a great sense of humor. And prior to doing a take, you know, we usually make fun of it. And that's part of the challenge, is to laugh about it. And then, turn of a dime, you turn serious. And, we make fun of it all the time.
Joining us on the show is award-winning actor Eric Braden, who stars in The Young and the Restless as Victor Newman. Make sure to check out his website, ericbraden.com. Eric is also going to be coming to Montreal on Saturday, March 24th, as part of the National Women's Show. You can find out ticket information at nationalwomenshow.com. Eric, can you give us a brief idea of what your day is like on set when you're shooting an episode of Y&R? Because I think a lot of people don't realize how much work actually goes into daytime programming, especially when you have a popular character like Victor, who's in so many different scenes and so many different storylines.
I was here at 8 this morning, and we'll probably be home by 6-7 at night, sometimes later, sometimes a little earlier. It depends, but I love it. So it's really not work in that sense. You know, I really enjoy doing it.
And do you get a chance to work out when you're at work, Eric? Because I know, like, you're very athletic, and I see you boxing all the time on the show, and I just wonder if you try to work your schedule in there.
I sometimes shadow box in my dressing room and do push-ups. But I usually work out at home or elsewhere every day. I work out once or twice every day, at least once a day, often twice.
And have you found that that keeps your head clear about everything else you have to do in your life, Eric?
You bet. It's the best medicine there is. Everything else, therapists and psychiatry, all that bullshit, is nonsense. Just work out. You know, really work out, get a sweat up, and you feel much better. And every person, every thinking person has conflicts and has stresses in life. You have to be, have to have a lobotomy not to think. So it's when you think about your relationships and people and family and the political scene and stresses, and the best way to relieve those stresses is not by drugs of any kind. No pharmaceuticals, nor recreational drugs. It doesn't work out. And then afterwards, have a nice dinner with friends or your family. But working out, in my case, boxing or lifting or playing tennis or soccer, whatever it may be, I do something every day. And it is vitally important. And I think we would reduce our health costs if a lot of people did that. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't grow up with that. In other words, you grow up with a certain discipline. When you're an athlete, you become addicted to working out. And that's a good addiction, you know?
You play such a high-powered and successful businessman, you know, on Young and the Restless. What's your take, actually, on the U.S. political landscape right now? Because, you know, the Republican nomination is coming up, and what do you think that's going to mean for Obama in the grand scheme of things?
Oh, I think it augurs well for Obama. I have a feeling he'll win again. Unless something very unusual happens to the economy, but the economy is on the way back. I hope that in the second 4 years, he's really going to be tough with Congress and attack those who try to undo him by any means possible. And I hope he goes on the attack. That was always the mistake of the Democrats before. They didn't hit back hard enough. You know, they didn't get back into the trenches. I personally think that he will win, and I think he is a very good president who had worked against enormous, enormous obstacles. He had to work against a Congress that was determined to finish his presidency after 4 years. And, I mean, they're determined, Carmela and Water. And I think he will prevail, because I think eventually Americans will see through it.
And if you were sitting in a Republican shoes right now and you saw the list of nominees, would you be upset? Because it seems like there is a lot of hot air and not a lot of substance right now.
It's a lot of hot air, and I would be very upset. And I hark back to the time when Republicans and Democrats made deals with each other, were ready to compromise, talking about the times of Eisenhower, even Nixon, and it all went downhill after that, sadly enough. But I've never seen this kind of chasm between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party or the rest of us as I've seen now. Never ever before.
No.
This is about as hostile of a Congress I've ever seen dealing with the president.
And do you sort of, because you come from Europe, do you keep an eye on what's happening over there? I know Greece is in trouble right now and a lot of the European countries. Does it bother you, Eric?
Well, of course it bothers me. And the difference is one of economic philosophy. A lot of people believe in Lord Maynard Keynes and the Keynesian solution to problems, namely more government spending in order to heat up the economy. And in order to give unemployed people jobs, which we could easily do in America, we could employ millions of people if Congress were willing to appropriate funds to rebuild America's infrastructure. We need new roads, new bridges, we need all kinds of things. And you would employ people publicly. That's what FDR did after the Depression. So, but the same kind of philosophic difference exists between Christine Lagarde, who is now the head of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and Angela Merkel, who is the Chancellor of Germany, who has to deal with internal political pressure, because the Germans say, listen, why are we saving and working hard when some other governments don't get their shit together? So it's an interesting debate right now. And of course, over here in America, you have those who preach austerity, and don't want us to bail out. Unfortunately, we only bail out the big banking institutions. And fortunately, we bail out Detroit. And look what happens now. The car industry is on its way back, coming back in a roaring way. It's wonderful. So I have a feeling I respect people's different views, but my instinct tells me that now when things are tough, you don't impose more restrictions as we do right now in Greece. I think you need to impose restrictions, but at the same time, sort of loosen the belt, I think.
If I bring you back to your movie career, Eric, you know, you portrayed John Jacob Astor in James Cameron's Titanic, which is actually going to be re-released on April 6th in 3D. I wanted to ask you, what was it like to be a part of such a historic movie?
Effectively, I didn't want to do it. I was talked into it by my wife and my son because they had enormous respect for James Cameron. And I turned down things before, and so I accepted it. And very reluctantly, because there wasn't enough in the script. And then because I had a deal with Y&R, I couldn't really spend all that time with Titanic, so I had to bow out of two or three scenes because I'd always, why not, had priority. But was it interesting to work on it? It was interesting to watch James Cameron direct this extraordinary opus. He is a genius as far as I'm concerned. I have deep respect for him. And I always thought all along, as we were shooting it, I was one of the few people who predicted that it would be very successful because I said it was a soap opera. And I know how successful soap operas are, but I said, this one is a very expensive one. So, turned out to be right. But I must say, I admire the courage, the brass balls of James Cameron, who kept on working, was not bothered at all by the fact that both 20th and Paramount, both studios, were shaking in their boots. They thought they would go down the drain because it had been the most expensive film in the history of Hollywood. So, but he stuck to his guns, and I've nothing but respect for him. I think he's also one of the most brilliant men in our business.
And a few years ago, Eric, you actually starred and executive produced a feature film called The Man Who Came Back. Was it challenging for you to not only have to act in the movie, but also be involved behind the scenes as an executive producer?
Good question. I loved it. I loved every aspect of it. But it came all to a screeching halt once you sign it over to a distribution company. That's usually when the music ends. They do with the film what they want and as they see fit, and they deal with a number of films at the same time, so it doesn't get the care and the love that you want it to get. I think the whole paradigm of for independent producers to put their heart and soul into something and finish it, and finally you make a deal with a distribution company and you never hear about the film again. And I think something is dreadfully wrong with that, and independent producers will have to find a different way to bring their products to the public.
Would you ever get involved in a project like that again, Eric, or did you get it?
I would if I got my money up front, you know, I would, and then you don't care so much what happens with the distribution afterwards. But if you do it for the love of it, and even invest in the film, then by no means give it to a distribution company to deal with it afterwards, because you won't see it die.
And, you know, you brought up Daytime just a few moments ago, again, about the Titanic movie and how, you know, you compared it to the two. I wanted to ask you, in the last couple of years, you know, we've lost so many Daytime programs, One Life to Live, All My Children. Does it make you nervous, Eric? Do you think the industry's in difficulty, challenging times?
Well, I found our ratings are strong, and there's no hole in the water. And people love to tell stories and love to hear stories. And some people call soaps the stories. And I think there's a reason for its popularity. But now that huge corporations have taken over a lot of the networks, it's all about the bottom line. And I think therein lies, you know, I think the fault sometimes. You have a corporate mentality that is interested in the bottom line and nothing else. Start dictating what is essentially a creative process. So, but it has always been thus in Hollywood. It has always been the conflict between show and business.
And Eric, what's it like for you when you meet some of your fans? Because I know you have such ardent supporters, and I know just, and I'm one of them. And I feel like you are part of my family because I've watched you for so many years. Do you appreciate that your fans have taken you into their homes, you know, on a weekly basis, 5 days a week?
I appreciate that deeply, and I thank you for saying that. I've had nothing, I would say 99.9% of my experiences with fans have been wonderful. And I've loved it. Nothing but good experiences, I must say. Yep.
And what was it like for you?
I appreciate it enormously.
What was it like for you when you actually received your star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame back in 2007, especially because you're the first German actor since Marlene Dietrich to actually receive one?
I was deeply touched by it, I got to tell you. That and the People's Choice Award meant more to me than anything. You know, to stand on Hollywood Boulevard, and obviously then one flashes back to when one came to that town, didn't have a dime in my pocket, and worked myself, you know, working for Beacons Moving Furniture and parking cars and doing all kinds of things and living from hand to mouth. Then to suddenly stand there, not suddenly, years afterwards, stand there and it was very touching, I must say. And it was very touching, primarily because I know that one day my granddaughter, who I adore, will go there and say, oh, that's Oprah's star. And that's something very close and means a lot to me. Yep.
And what's it like being a grandfather? Because I know I've seen you in other interviews and you talk such glowing words about your granddaughter.
There's nothing like it. I love it. It's the best, I must say, the best feeling I've ever had. Now I have a second one. And she is now 6 or 7 months old. And Tatiana is eight years old. And I adore her. And Oksana is the youngest one. She is beginning to respond and smile and laugh. And it's so sweet. I grew up with, you know, we were four brothers at home after the war. It was tough. Fights all the time. And played ice hockey and soccer and just sports all my life. Then I had my son, and I took him into boxing and all that. And now to have a little, you know, Tatiana is a granddaughter and Oksana, it's such a wonderful feeling. It's so different. Girls are just so different. It's sweet.
And yeah. I have to tell you, when I see you on screen on Y&R acting with some of the younger actors, I don't think you're acting, because you just seem like you're having such a great time with these younger actors, and the expression on your face just basically says it all, so I can imagine how you are with your own granddaughters.
Yeah, I love it. Just love it.
Thank you so much for joining us, and continued success on YNR and any other project that you take up.
You bet. À la semaine prochaine.
C'est bien ça. Okay. Merci beaucoup.
Oui.
Merci beaucoup.
Merci
Eric.
De rien. Mon plaisir. Au revoir.
That's award-winning actor Eric Braden, who stars in The Young and the Restless as Victor Newman. Check out his website, ericbraden.com.
Capture your need for sound.
What seems like a long wait filled with anticipation, Apple has recently unveiled their latest product, a new and improved iPad. Syndicated technology columnist Mark Saltzman was at the unveiling in California, and he's here to tell us all about this latest edition of the iPad. Mark, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. Great to chat with you.
First of all, Mark, was the new iPad worth the wait and the build-up to its launch?
Well, no product can match the hype that a product like the iPad gets prior to its release. I mean, it could make you breakfast, and it still wouldn't live up to the tremendous hype and all the rumors and speculation that precedes the event. So, you know, in Apple's defense, you know, it's tough. You know, there's so much. Apple is the world's hottest company, and they never reveal what they're about to show. So that combination, you know, fosters all these rumors. So it's very, very hard to live up to that. So before I talk about what I do like about the new iPad, it should be said that, you know, there's always that tinge of disappointment at the beginning when you're sitting in the audience. Tim Cook takes the stage and shows the product, or Steve Jobs before him. And you're always kind of like, oh, you know, but then once you actually get your hands on it, as many of your listeners know, Kelly, the Apple's products, it's very much about the experience. The magic is actually in the touching and in the interaction with that product.
And speaking of the audience, of you being there in the room, was it a similar sort of feeling like it was when the 4S, the iPhone 4S was launched? Because I know there was a, you know, if you want to use the word disappointment there too.
Yeah, and that's a fair word as well. So the iPhone 4S event was much smaller. It was at Apple's headquarters last October. So there was maybe 100 people in the audience at most. This event was at the Yerba Center for the Arts in San Francisco, a bigger auditorium that seats about 400, maybe more. So it was on a bigger scale, but still, I would agree that the features that were unveiled on the iPad, they looked impressive, but still we're waiting for that one, like, wow, this is the future is here, right? And there were so many rumors about it having, you know, some tactile feedback and sort of vibration technology that lets you feel textures. We've heard about holograms. I mean, none of that came out. And you know, truthfully, it's still a much better product than the previous one, but they don't make huge leaps forward. But they do, you know, they do have features that were not found in its predecessor. So definitely, if you look at the product, it is the best tablet on the market. But it isn't like a futuristic, you know what I mean? It's not that much of a leap forward from the iPad 2, but enough that if you haven't bought one yet, then most definitely you're going to want the third iPad.
And can I ask you, just before you launch into the improvements, Mark, why is it not being called the iPad 3? Because from what I understand, it was just sort of touted out as the new iPad.
Yeah, so there's no number. I guess they just felt like, okay, well, how long are we going to keep doing this iPad 3, iPad 4? So on one hand, that's Apple's way. They're all about minimalism and simplification. So iPad, that's it. And that really is aligned with Apple's marketing strategy, keeping it simple. However, I do feel that it could cause some confusion at retail, because if you walk into an Apple store, you're going to think automatically the iPad 2 is more advanced than the iPad because it's the number 2 after it. So therefore, you think it's the newest one. So that's going to cause some confusion unless you're tech savvy and you just know that the new one is simply called iPad, or the sales clerk is going to explain that to you and remind you, you know, yeah, the iPad 2, which is now on sale for $419, so it's $100 off the price it was a week ago. That one is last year's model, but the new iPad, simply called iPad, is really the third generation product.
And so, speaking of this new iPad, what are the improvements to the tablet, Mark?
Okay, so number one is a much better looking screen. It's got 4 times the resolution as last year's iPad. So that means that when you're flicking through photos or watching videos or playing games, even reading text, like in an ebook app, it just looks unbelievable. There's never been a higher definition screen in a mobile device ever. In fact, it has more pixels, you know, the little dots that make up the image, than your HD TV has. So we're talking screen quality and clarity and detail and color that you've never seen before. So that's something that's very hard to communicate on stage. But following the event, I had some hands-on time with the iPad, and it's like, wow. So that's number one. The second thing, Kelly, is new wireless technology. So it uses LTE, long-term evolution, also referred to as 4G wireless speeds. In many cities in Canada, the big three carriers, Bell Mobility, Rogers, and TELUS, have 4G networks or LTE networks rolled out. And what this is in plain English is essentially broadband-like speed. So you're now going to get, through cell phone signals, faster, you know, if not at the same speed, if not even faster than your home's internet connection. So therefore, you can stream movies. There's no buffering. It just starts right away. You can download files in mere seconds that otherwise could take, you know, a minute or two. So it embraces 4G or LTE, as we refer to it, across all carriers. But not all of the new iPads have that. You have to buy the one that takes a little SIM card. And those are a little bit more money. The new iPads start at $519 for the Wi-Fi version, but $649 rather for the Wi-Fi plus 4G model.
Joining us on the show this week is syndicated technology columnist Mark Saltzman from Toronto. Make sure you follow him on Twitter, Mark_Saltzman. Mark, what's up with this voice dictation? Now, because I was hearing about this at the launch, and I understand it's not Siri, it's something different.
Right. So I was hoping that Siri, which is the voice-activated personal assistant in the iPhone 4S, I was hoping that would be in the iPad as well. So you can, you know, basically talk to the tablet and have a human-like voice answer you and give you the information you need. Unfortunately, it's not quite Siri, but there is voice dictation. So that means you can start an email or a text message or even surf the web using your voice. So it's voice to text. So whatever you say into your iPad, the words will show up on the screen. So it may be faster for you to do that than to type, say, a lengthy email. So that's the good news, that at least it has some kind of speech to text technology in there, and support for third-party apps like Facebook or Twitter. You can also speak your tweets, but
wow.
There is no full Siri, so you're not going to hear a human-like voice back. You can't like say, you know, book me a calendar appointment and it'll automatically open that app for you. Siri goes above and beyond voice dictation, but at least the iPad has some of that. Maybe they're just waiting for it to roll it out gradually. Don't forget, Siri isn't even version 1.0 yet. It's still in beta, so it's still being tested. So maybe they felt it wasn't ready for the new iPad. You know, I'm not sure, but I've got a book coming out the same day that the new iPad comes out called Siri for Dummies. It's an ebook, and I was hoping, of course, selfishly, that Siri would be in the new iPad, but unfortunately, it's not. But voice dictation is there. So definitely, Kelly, the two biggest additions to the iPad are the screen quality and the wireless connectivity. And then some of the extra things are things like voice dictation, a better camera. It's now what's called an EyeSight camera on the back that can take 5-megapixel stills with image stabilization, or 1080p video recording, which is better than last year's 720p camera in the iPad.
And for anyone who is into taking pictures, is this something really exciting for them then? Because I know it feels kind of awkward to be taking pictures with an iPad.
You know, I thought the same thing. And of course, you know, it's not pocket size. This is a tablet that's almost 10 inches. But it's one of those things where it's convenient if you've got it with you. I remember I was, you know, my daughter had a birthday party last July, and she had some friends over at a dance. Like, we hired a dancer to dance with the girls and to teach them dancing. And my camera wasn't charged up, but I had the iPad on my lap. So all I did was tap record, and it was still HD in last year's model, just not as high as the new one. And I got some beautiful video. And yeah, you might look a little silly holding up an iPad with two hands as a camcorder, but in a pinch, it works and works well. So it's one of those convenience things where, you know, it's probably better to bring a standalone camera or camcorder with you. But if you've got the iPad, and I personally bring my iPad with me wherever I go, then it's at least built in there.
Now, can you talk to me a little bit about the battery? Because is it the same as the iPad too? Or because I understand that there's a faster processor. So is the battery being drained quicker?
Okay, so the great thing about the new iPad is not only did they add all those new things, the better screen, better wireless technology, faster processor, better camera, and voice dictation, but the battery life remains the same, and no one yet has topped iPad in the tablet space. So 10 hours still for most tasks, 9 hours on 4G, so that's that next generation wireless technology. If you use 4G, you can last 9 hours. So nobody has topped that yet. All the Android tablets out there, the BlackBerry Playbook. So Apple has maintained that same battery performance. There is a small catch, however. It's a slightly bigger battery than the one that was in last year's iPad to accommodate these new features. So as a result, the iPad is a little bit heavier and a little bit thicker than last year's model. And there's two issues there. One is that if you're reading an ebook for a long period of time, almost a 1.5 pound tablet may be too heavy. That's, you know, probably twice the weight of a BlackBerry Playbook. So that could be heavy. And the second problem is that if you've bought accessories for last year's iPad, like let's say a fitted case, like a fitted sleeve or case,
right,
it may not fit 100% on the new iPad. It might be really tight because it is a bit thicker to accommodate the slightly bigger battery. So those are the two downsides, I would say, with the new iPad. It's slightly heavier, slightly thicker, but still, you know, you're splitting hairs when it comes to the thickness. It's still only a few millimeters. It's like 9.5 millimeters thick instead of 8.8. So, you know, it's really not a big deal, but the weight could be if you read for a long period of time.
And Mark, is there still no external connection like a USB port?
There is still no USB connection, and I didn't think Apple would finally add one after all these years, nor can you surf the web and access websites with Flash. These are things that Apple feels that we're moving away from. So you're not going to find USB ports on an iPad. Everything is moving to the cloud. It's going to be stored online. Apple unveiled their iCloud service last fall. So you can access files remotely as if it was stored on your device and upload to the cloud as if you had a USB stick stuck in there. It does, you know, if you don't have an internet connection, that's another story, and that's where it can be a little bit of a hindrance. But for the most part, Apple feels like that's all, you know, not for the iPad. You can do that on the Mac computers, of course, but they're saying, look, on a tablet, we don't think this makes sense. And the same with Flash websites. The internet is now moving towards HTML5, which is another tool to use websites with animation and video. So a lot of people were hoping that they would add a Flash to this iPad, but Apple is not a fan of Adobe and of Flash. And in fact, Steve Jobs wrote a lengthy blog post about it before he passed on, you know, a year before he passed away. So that's not in the new iPad either.
Now, is the price going to be relative to the iPad 2 when it was launched last year?
Yeah, so that's so the good thing about and Apple's good for this, that they add new features every year, but the battery life remains the same and the price remains the same. So the new iPads start at $519, just like last year's iPad 2 did. But you're getting a lot more bang for your buck. And then the existing iPad 2, the one that came out last year at this time, is dropped $100 down to $419. And then if you want the new iPad with 4G wireless connectivity, so the ability to surf the internet at high speeds, even when there's no wireless network around you, even on a park bench or in the back of a moving train, you can get that, but it starts at $649. So you pay a little bit more than $100 for that, for that convenience.
And something I wanted to ask you about that, Mark, because, you know, a lot of people now are using their iPhones as a hotspot. So in your opinion, do you really need to get the LTE now on this new iPad,
right,
or the 3G? Because
yeah, great point, Kelly. So if your smartphone, and arguably if you have one, you carry it with you everywhere because it's pocket sized. If you've got a smartphone with you that is capable of creating a hotspot, therefore any nearby Wi-Fi devices can get online through cellular service, then you don't need the new 4G iPad, except your smartphone is probably not 4G yet. So therefore, you'll be able to get online wirelessly with the new iPad, but you won't get the same high speeds as it offers with its built-in 4G support.
And overall, how do you feel about this new iPad? Because I know you already have one. Would you go out and get this upgrade?
I would say that if you have an iPad 2, if you have last year's version, I would not upgrade. It's a terrific device, the one that came out a year ago at this time. It has dual cameras, which was not in the first iPad, and a faster processor. So I don't think that, you got to throw this out or give it to somebody and buy the new one. Yes, there are a number of improvements. First and foremost, that screen is stunning. But if you have an iPad 2, I'd say you're fine. If you have a first-generation iPad or another tablet that came out a couple of years ago, then when you see what this new iPad looks like and what it can do, you'll be very tempted to upgrade.
And Mark, do you feel that they are going to improve it more in the next year or so? Like, because is there more place to go, I guess, is what I'm asking for with the iPad?
I know. And the answer is yes. And Apple always finds a way to do it, whether it's a major upgrade or a modest one. There is room to grow. They could add Siri to the next one. They can make the screen even better, I'm sure. I don't know how, but Apple, if anybody can find a way, Apple can. So yeah, there is room to grow. So I think that they're already probably working on next year's model and sourcing the parts and all that. So, it's exciting. I mean, this is a very exciting time in the tech space, especially when it comes to mobility, like smartphones and tablets, because innovation is everywhere, everywhere you turn your head. And it's not just Apple, Samsung and other these other companies have these amazing innovations that they're pouring into their products.
And Mark, before I let you go, now we've had this most recent Apple unveiling, and I know, as you've told me many times before, they keep their cards close to their chest. But what is your gut telling you about what's next for Apple, like with a new product rollout?
Well, for next for Apple, there's a couple of things, and Tim Cook did hint and tease at the end of his chat, by the way, on Wednesday, that there is lots of things coming in 2012. We didn't chat about the new Apple TV product that came out that was announced on Wednesday. This is a new small box that you connect to your TV that gives you access to the iTunes store and more. So that now has some extra features, including support for 1080p video, which is a top-of-the-line video. But coming in 2012, we'll see the iPhone 5, maybe in the fall. It'll likely have a larger screen and, you know, a few more bells and whistles not found in the iPhone 4. We may even see an iTV. So this is Apple's long-rumored television, apparently Steve Jobs' last big project that has, you know, fuses the internet with television with a beautiful display. So hopefully that'll be unveiled at some point in 2012.
Fantastic. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate
it. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
That's Mark Saltzman again, a syndicated technology columnist from Toronto. Follow him on Twitter, Mark_Saltzman.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
I wanted to talk to you about an artist that is making a lot of noise these days. His real name is Walter DeBacker, but he actually goes by Gautier. And I had never heard of the man except for a couple of weeks ago when we started to play his song, Somebody That I Used to Know, on the radio station that I work for. Before that, not a clue, even though I know he's been around for a couple of years. The reason I wanted to bring him to your attention is because he's very fresh. It's a fresh sound. It's something that we haven't heard for a while because, you know, everything right now is so driven by beat. It's so almost samey, if I can use that word, if you're looking at pop music. And this is just different. He's using lots of different instrumentation that is simple instruments, but put together, it just makes a really sort of funky and eclectic sound. And I'm not surprised that the song, Somebody That I Used to Know, has actually made it to number one in 13 countries around the world, and it continues to blow up. And no one is more shocked, actually, than Gautier himself. He said that he was very shocked to be receiving all this chart success. It was not something that he expected at all, especially considering the fact that it took him at least 2 years to actually write and record this song. He said that when he started to write it, he got the first sort of bit down immediately, and then he basically hit a brick wall and didn't know how to finish the song. So it took him some time to work things out, but he managed to sort of barrel through and finish the song. And he recorded it actually in his studio, which is in a former barn in Australia. That's where he lives. He's got a bunch of different sort of heritage going on. He was born in Belgium, but moved to Australia when he was 2. And now he has this kick butt studio in a barn, and that's where he does all of his work. And he is just really making noise, and it's a really interesting song, and I wanted to make sure that I presented it to you so that you can see that there is really interesting things going on in pop music. I know, you know, if you take a look at what we've been listening to for the last little while, you know, there's Katy Perry, Rihanna, Lady Gaga, a lot of it is similar, and this is just not. And it reminds me, not sort of musically sounding, but just the fact that when we heard Adele, she is so different. It's just different what we're hearing from her. And Gautier is also different. So I think this is something that you're going to enjoy. And if you haven't heard the song yet, I am very excited to present this song to you called Somebody That I Used to Know from Gautier off his album Making Mirrors on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Because I can never happen, and now we were nothing. looks are so deceiving.
Jason Derulo with Breathing, remixed by Mike Rizzo on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, including actor Eric Braden, as well as technology columnist Mark Saltzman. As per usual, I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time coming from Roderick Thorpe. We have to learn to be our own best friends because we fall too easily into the trap of being our own worst enemies. There you go. Have an awesome week. Any comments or questions? Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.